It's Thursday, February 6, 2014. I'm Albert Mohler, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Headlines across the nation are reporting a decrease in the number of abortions in America, and that certainly looks like good news. The news is coming from the nation's media, reporting headlines ricocheting across the country on the fact that both the number of abortions and the percentage of pregnancies ending in abortion has been falling. And falling to levels that basically go back all the way to 1973, the very year that the Roe v. Wade decision was handed down by the United States Supreme Court. That was the decision that legalized abortion on demand. So is this big news? Well, those concerned about the sanctity of human life will certainly celebrate when any abortion doesn't happen, when there is any decrease or reduction in the number of abortions or in the percentage of abortions. But a closer look at the data coming from the Guttmacher Institute, that's a pro-abortion organization that is trusted in terms of its numbers by both sides in the abortion controversy, it tells us that there is something here we need to note, but it might be far less than meets the eye. For instance, let's look at the ratio of abortions to pregnancy. In other words, how many pregnancies end in abortion? If you go back to the year 2008, it was 23 per 100. In the last year, that's 2012, according to the Guttmacher Institute, it was 21 out of 100. In other words, a fall of 2%. But let's think about those numbers for a moment. That means that we are shifting from almost 1 out of 4 pregnancies ending in abortion to approximately 1 out of 5. That might be progress of some sort, but it points to the fact that there are just so many abortions in America, both the ratio and the number defy the imagination of most Americans, who simply would rather not think about the numbers that are represented here. Here's another number. There were 121 million abortions performed in America in 2008, that according to the Guttmacher data. In 2011, that was down to 1.06 million, a fall-off of almost 200,000 abortions. Is that good news? Of course it's good news. But when you look at this data, you all of a sudden recognize we're in big trouble in knowing what we're talking about here. The biggest issue is this. Not reported in this entire body of data are abortions that are now conducted rather routinely through the offices of medical doctors who use medical abortions rather than surgical abortions. The reality is that of the abortions that are reported from abortion clinics, almost 25% of them are actually medical abortions, not surgical abortions. But that means that there is likely to be found an enormous number, potentially hundreds of thousands, of abortions being conducted in doctors' offices that are never reported. So even as the headlines are saying there are now fewer abortions in America than in the recent past, and there's been a fall off even in the percentage of pregnancies that end in abortion, by the time you reach the end of the most responsible articles, you come to the hard and very disappointing conclusion that we actually know no such thing. We actually have no idea of how many chemical abortions, medical abortions, are being performed in America. And we need to keep in mind from a pro-life perspective that it doesn't matter, in this case, the technology that ends the pregnancy. It matters that the pregnancy is terminated, that the unborn life is killed, that what you're looking at here is the abortion of a living human being. But whether it's done by a pill or by a surgical instrument doesn't change the fact that this is the intentional destruction of life within American wombs. So it's very interesting that all of a sudden you have these headlines being sent all over the media about a fall-off in abortion, and it's being celebrated by the pro-choice community and by feminists and others who've been pushing for legal abortion and pushing against all these restrictions recently adopted by various states in terms of abortion. So what's going on here? Well, what's going on here is this. Those in the pro-choice, the pro-abortion community, are pointing to these numbers and saying, look, what we have here is the victory of programs trying to get contraceptives into the hands of people so that they will not get pregnant and thus need an abortion. Well, that may or may not have something to do with this, but that would be a completely different argument. The real argument here is over abortion. And the real question is whether these numbers actually tell us anything about a fall off in abortion and a reduction in the procedure in America. By the time you reach the end of this report, you come to the very painful conclusion that the reality could be exactly the opposite and we wouldn't know. Because perhaps the most haunting aspect of all of these news reports is the fact that given the fact that abortion can now be routinely handled in most doctors' offices at the early stages of a pregnancy with a pill rather than with a surgical intervention, and that there is no necessity of this being reported to anyone, any place, at any time for any reason, in reality, the headlines are telling us abortions declined to lowest since the 1970s. They're telling us that because the numbers that were selected from this research indicate that to be true. But there's where the informed person has to look at the numbers and say, what do they actually tell us? Sad to say, they may tell us no such thing. From the perspective of the Christian worldview, concerned for the sanctity of human life, there are few articles more revealing than the one that appeared this week in Tuesday's edition of the New York Times. The front page headline is this: Gene Tests, Healthy Children, and Ethical Doubt. Gina Collada, one of the most excellent reporters in terms of biomedical issues in the country today, reports that there are more couples now screening embryos, but this is giving rise to a series of very difficult ethical questions. Collada in her article goes first to a woman who is now a mother. But before she became a mother, she received a genetic diagnosis concerning herself. She found out that she's a carrier of a very rare genetic disease that will lead to a very painful and agonizing death in all likelihood between her ages of 30 and 50. But she has become pregnant. How she became pregnant is a very important issue. She said that when she found out she had this disease, she made the immediate determination that she would not bear a child simply because of the risk that the child would be born with the same genetic ailment. She did not want that to happen. So as Collada explains, quote, like a growing number of couples who know a disease runs in the family, they chose in vitro fertilization and had cells from the embryos created in a petri dish with her eggs and his sperm tested for the disease-causing gene, end quote. So just to make this very clear, here you have the woman who has this genetic diagnosis concerning herself. She and her husband use in vitro fertilization technology in order to produce embryos. The embryos are then screened for the disease, and only the embryos that lack the marker for the disease are candidates for implantation in her womb. This is becoming rather routine. It's becoming rather standard medicine in America. The ethical issues are arising, and the fact that they are arising tells us something about the fact that there's a lingering pro-life impulse or intuition, even among those who are already using advanced reproductive technologies and presumably already making the decision not to implant some of the embryos that are created by that technology. That's exactly what this couple, the Kalinskis, did. As Collada reports, only embryos without the gene were implanted in her womb. The Kalinskis are now parents of twin 3-year-olds, Ava and Cole, and 9-month-old Tatum, children who will be free of the fear of the disease their mother carries. Collada then reports, and I quote, genetic testing of embryos has been around for more than a decade, but its use has soared in recent years as methods have improved and more disease-causing genes have been discovered. The in vitro fertilization and testing are expensive, typically about $20,000, but they make it possible for couples to ensure that their children will not inherit a faulty gene and to avoid the difficult choice of whether to abort a pregnancy if testing of a fetus determines a genetic problem, end quote. So this takes us back to the issue we just previously discussed, the claim that there has been a reduction in the number of abortions in America and the presumption that that means good news. But when you look at this, what you're seeing is a pushback. You're seeing a pushback from people who say we don't want to have to abort a child by their thinking, so we will simply discard an embryo. They're pushing the issue back to an earlier stage of human development as if that is an ethical gain. The mother in this case told the New York Times that getting pregnant and then deciding what to do would have been more difficult. In her words, quote, for me, destroying a fetus that is already growing inside of me was much different than discarding embryos that had not yet been implanted, end quote. So as we look to her comment, we don't have to wonder what she means. She tells us exactly what she means. She means that she sees the issue of destroying a fetus in the womb as being of greater moral significance than destroying an embryo in the laboratory. There are multiple ethical issues involved here. Gina Collada reports that ethical questions have troubled advocates for the disabled and left some doctors struggling with what they would tell or should tell their patients. She writes, quote, when are prospective parents justified in discarding embryos? Is it acceptable, for example, for intractable genetic diseases that develop in adulthood? What if a gene only increases the risk of a disease? And should people be able to use it to pick whether they have a boy or a girl? A recent international survey found that 2% of more than 27,000 uses of pre-implantation diagnoses were made to choose a child's sex, end quote. Now, that also takes us back to our previous story. And the bottom line in that is the fact that what's missing is the data coming from abortions that are never reported. What this points to is a very similar and parallel, very ominous kind of development. We have people who are using pre-implantation genetic diagnosis in order to decide which embryos to implant, but they don't have to tell us why they're making the decision, on what basis they're making the choice. They could very well be making the decision on the basis of gender or any number of other reportable characteristics, and there is no medical or legal necessity for them to tell us why. Furthermore, as Gina Collada's story here makes very clear, there are overlapping opportunities. If you have a complete profile on these embryos, then you can choose the embryo, perhaps even saying to yourself, we're choosing this embryo because it's free of the marker for a genetic disease. but maybe you're also choosing that embryo because you want to balance in your family. We previously talked about the fact that there are medical ethicists who are arguing that balancing gender within a family is an ethically acceptable reason for this kind of choice and selection of embryos. This article makes very clear that those who are in this medical practice generally accept that there must be some ethical boundaries, but that the general use of the procedure is ethically justified. Their question is not whether the procedure is ever justified, but under what conditions it should be justified. There is so much in this from a worldview perspective. For one thing, you have some doctors in here saying, what about these diseases that appear in adulthood? If we are sanctioning the destruction of those embryos, are we saying to the people who now carry these diseases and are alive as adults today, it would have been better had you never been born? There is a very significant issue of messaging in these ethical decisions being made. That's why advocates for the disabled are coming back and saying, look, you're talking about destroying us before we're born. Let's be very honest about what we're talking about here. We're talking about coming up with a template of ideal or at least minimally acceptable humanity, and those embryos that are found to be beneath human expectation, acceptable expectation, are simply never implanted and eventually destroyed. But from a Christian worldview perspective, there's more here about the sanctity of human life. Why is it that for some reason, even many Christians, even many evangelical Christians, even many people as evangelical Christians who believe themselves to be committed to the sanctity of human life, why is it so many don't recognize that the sanctity of human life has to follow at every point in the developmental continuum? This became very, very crucial in recent years with efforts to pass so-called personhood amendments in several states. The most crucial of these happened just a couple of years ago in the state of Mississippi. According to virtually every survey or research instrument available to us, the most pro-life state in the entire union is Mississippi. And yet the voters of Mississippi turned down a human personhood amendment. Why did they do that? Research after the electoral decision came to the conclusion that there were many who considered themselves pro-life within Mississippi who simply did not think that the pro-life argument has to be extended all the way back to fertilization, all the way back to that very early embryonic status. So what we're looking at here is a failure of even many in the pro-life community to understand why the dignity and the sanctity of every human life must be pressed back to the very earliest, indeed the beginning points of human existence and then of human development all the way until natural death. If at any point we sacrifice or compromise that, we are subverting and undermining the sanctity of human life for every human being at every point of development, including those of us who are alive today. That's why the advocates for the disabled get the point that many others miss. You're talking about us. You're not just talking about embryos. You're not just talking about unborn children. You're talking about us. You're telling us that it would have been better had we never been born. But from the perspective of a Christian worldview and from the sanctity of human life, what's even more ominous in this article is the shift in the argument from what is permissible to what should be obligatory. In other words, when should it be considered virtually mandatory to destroy an embryo or to fail to implant it, leading to its ultimate destruction, when there is some kind of genetic indicator that there could be a problem with the embryo? In other words, there are those who are arguing now not only that it's ethically justifiable to destroy certain embryos, but there is a moral responsibility to do so. The shift in that argument is exactly what took place in Weimar Germany amongst the German medical ethicists who were laying the very groundwork for what became the Third Reich. The idea that there was life unworthy of life, Lebensunwertensleben, as the Germans called it, took a hold of the entire German medical establishment. It became standard operating procedure. We can only imagine what the Nazi doctors would have done had they had the kind of genetic technologies and assisted reproductive technologies that are available today. We are effectively putting the power that these German doctors claimed to have back in the 1930s in the hands of the average physician operating with advanced reproductive technologies. One final but very serious ethical complication that arises in this article comes down to this. We simply don't have the genetic expertise to make the kind of decisions that many doctors and many parents are now trying to make. This article by Gina Collada is very honest. There are no genetic markers that are so clearly indicated for things like breast cancer. There may be patterns genetically that can be detected that might point to a percentage or a propensity towards the development of some kind of disease, such as breast cancer. But there is no simple test that simply says this child is almost certain to develop breast cancer if indeed the child is born. So what we're looking at here is the fact that we have the destruction of many embryos and in all likelihood the abortion of many unborn children simply because it is suspected that they well might carry a genetic marker they might have the risk of leading eventually to some kind of disease or other unacceptable condition. Every one of the issues that has arisen in this article is important, and credit goes to the New York Times for putting an article this magnitude on its front page. The real question is anyone reading it? Does anyone really care? Along similar lines comes an opinion piece written by Charles Krauthammer, the very influential and respected columnist for The Washington Post. He writes an article entitled "Stick to Policy, Advance the Fight Against Abortion." He's writing about the controversy about certain Republican statements about women, and he says what Republicans ought to do is focus on the pro-life issue. But how Charles Krauthammer, who is both an attorney and a medical doctor, would have us to focus on abortion tells us a great deal about his worldview and why we should consider our own. He writes, quote, "There is a very simple, straightforward strategy for seizing the high ground on abortion in a way that transcends the normal divisions and commands wide popular support." He writes, "Focus on the horror of late-term abortion and get it banned." He then writes, "Last year's Kermit Gosnell trial was a seminal moment. The country was shown a baby butcher at work, and national sentiment was nearly unanimous. Abortion rights advocates ran away from Gosnell, but they can't hide from the issue." He cites the late Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan for saying that as he looked at the late-term abortion procedure, he said at first he thought it came dangerously close to infanticide. But Senator Moynihan, to his own moral credit, after looking at the procedure, came back and said it doesn't come close to being infanticide. It is infanticide. But then Charles Krauthammer makes a very interesting, subtle, and dangerous argument. He makes the argument this way. He says, focus on late-term abortions because everyone recognizes that it's the abortion of a living child. Don't pay attention, he says, don't press any legislative agenda, at least any time in the near future, on early-term abortions. Let that go. Because as pro-lifers focus on even early-term abortions, Krauthammer says, they're missing the fact that there is a moral consensus on the part of Americans about late-term abortion. And then he writes this paragraph, quote, "There remains profound disagreement as to whether at this earlier stage the fetus has acquired personhood, or, to put it more theologically, ensoulment. The disagreement is understandable, given that the question is a matter of faith," end quote. Well, that's a matter of tremendous theological and moral confusion. I don't know of anyone of any theological variety, evangelical, Protestant, Roman Catholic, Eastern Orthodox, you could go down the list, who actually is talking in any way about what can be described as ensoulment. Charles Krauthammer here is not writing as a Christian. He is himself a largely secular Jew, according to the media. And as he looks at this issue, he's looking for the traditional Jewish understanding that at quickening, with the movement in the mother's abdomen, there is the actual recognition that human life has come and deserves to be protected. We have to press back against that. We have to be very, very clear that a consistent understanding of the sanctity of human life means that human life has to be understood as being fully human, fully alive, and fully deserving of human dignity, indeed possessing the sanctity of life, from the moment of fertilization until natural death. The moment we begin to write off the earliest inhabitants of the womb as being expendable for the cause of our moral argument and for a populist victory on the issue of banning late-term abortions, we violate the very principles for which we say we stand. Charles Krauthammer, on many issues, is a very reliable guide. He's one of the most responsible voices writing in opinion columns and appearing on talk television today. On so many things, he is a voice of reason and righteousness, but on this one, he's betraying the fact that his worldview doesn't actually assign the dignity and sanctity of human life to human beings at every point of development. But the moment we begin to compromise the sanctity of human life at any point of human development, we subvert the sanctity of human life for every human being at every stage of development. As I come to a close, I want to remind you to listen to our weekly program, the new program entitled Ask Anything Weekend Edition. It was released first last Saturday. A new edition will be released this Saturday and every Saturday hereafter. So give us a call at 877-505-2058. Leave the question in your voice. We'll try to get to it as soon as possible. Again, the phone number, 877-505-2058. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.